Good evening, everybody. We are at Megillas Rus in the first parak, in the second parak, I'm sorry, chapter 2, and we're at verse Pasuk Yud Dalet 14. And we are at Boaz said to her at the meal time, "Come here and eat bread, dip your piece in vinegar." She sat beside the reapers. We already did this, I think, a bit last time. And he handed her parched grain. And she ate and was satisfied that she had some left over. Yeah? So we already discussed the fact as to what does it mean that it says, sit, come here. The fact that he said, come here, eat bread, dip your piece in vinegar. And it only says that she ate parched grain. And we said that she only ate a little bit of parched grain and was so full that she didn't even need to eat the bread, which is why that there's a discrepancy between her being told what to eat and what to do. And we wanted to discuss a bit something to do, excuse me, with this parched grain. Now, there's really so much discuss. When I mean pages upon pages upon pages of discussion, that it is impossible to go through it here and like, it would need the whole evening just to discuss this parched grain. So what I'd like to do, if possible, is go through to the Medrash Rabbah. And the Medrash Rabbah has a tremendous amount to discuss on this parched grain. And it says here on this actual pasuk, she ate and was so satisfied that she let some over. She kept some to the side. So if you see the Medrash Rabbah, which is right here, which is Rus Rabbah, base Yud Dalet, which is in Parsha Hay. And if you open up a Medrash Rabbah, you'll see it in section 5 of the Medrash Rabbah. And it says like this. This is talking about the Messiah. When it means come over here, he's talking about the Messiah. And the royal descendant of Rus, whose rule will usher in the Messianic era, and is to be interpreted as follows. When Boaz said, come over here, he meant that Rus would come near to the monarchy and partake of the bread, which is an allusion to the bread of monarchy. And dip your morsel in the vinegar. This is an allusion to the afflictions that the Mashiach is destined to undergo. As it says concerning the Mashiach, he is pained because of our rebellious sins and oppressed through our iniquities. The chastisement upon him is for our benefit, and through his wounds we are healed. That's Isaiah 53:5, which is completely misunderstood by Christianity to refer to Yoshki. So she sat beside the harvesters. That alludes to the fact that the Mashiach's monarchy will be temporarily wrested away from him. There's going to be all kinds of challenges to the Mashiach. As it says in Zechariah 14:2, I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem for the war, and the city will be captured. So when Gog and Magog starts the war preceding the Messianic revelation, there will look as if it will go badly, and Jerusalem will fall into the hands of the enemy. When he said he handed her parched grain, that indicates the monarchy will ultimately return to him following the war. As it says, he will strike the evildoers of the world with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked in Isaiah 11:4. So there's a tremendous discussion here that just as the first Redeemer initially appeared to the Israelites and was then concealed for a time, and for how long was he concealed? 3 months. As it says, concerning the Israelite foremen who oversaw their slave labourers, they encountered Moshe and Aaron standing opposite them as they left Pharaoh's presence. The first Redeemer was Moses, and Moses was hidden for 3 months because he was premature. He was born at the end of the second trimester, and therefore he wasn't known about until the when the Egyptian taskmasters came in. They were counting 9 months, and he was born after 6 months but was viable. So that's what it means, the first Redeemer, he was a Messiah in his generation, was hidden for 3 months. So too the final Redeemer will appear to the Jewish people and then will then be concealed for them for this time. There will be some kind of period where he will not be known about. So the purpose of this concealment is to fool Goyim into thinking that the Mashiach has failed. They will then harden their hearts and not repent ensuring their ultimate demise, says the Eitz Yosef. So at the time of the Messiah will turn up and everyone will go, ooh, the Jewish Messiah is here. Maybe we ought to be very careful, especially how we're dealing with the Jews. Then for 3 months, he'll disappear off the face of the earth. Or he'll be incognito, and everyone will think he's dead for 3 months. Okay, 3 months. Then he's got to come back. What's that 3 months for? To make sure the goyim think, oh gosh, maybe we shouldn't Magai, we shouldn't do tshuva. To make sure that their true colours, just like Pharaoh's true colours, need to be ascertained. The Medrash Tanchuma, which is the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma, says that it's 45 days that he'll be disappeared for. As it's written, from the time the daily offering was removed and the mute abomination put in place, 1,290 days. It was also written, praiseworthy is he who waits and reaches 1,335 days. So what does that mean? How do we interpret that? We understand that that's talking about the ultimate redemption arriving after a slightly longer period of 1,335 days. So the contradiction is, there's what, 95 versus 1,335. It concludes that the Messiah will first appear at the time prescribed in our verse, i.e. at the particular time that he's meant to turn up, and then be concealed for 1,335 minus 1,290, which gives 45 days. Goes to a very complicated discussion, but the point is the Messiah comes and goes. And all of that is alluded to in this eating of this parched grain is the final redemption. It says she ate and was satisfied, so too King Manasseh, who was wicked, but was he did tshuva at the end of his life, even though it wasn't a full tshuva in the fact that God would give him back his entire kingdom. He's going to eat in this world and eat in the next. He'll still get Olam Haba. And we learn out that's what it means he was satisfied. So the entire monarchy of Manasseh will also be returned. He'll get his life back. All of this, as I say, is a tremendously deep, please go and see the Medrash. It's absolutely incredible. It's a tremendously deep idea about the Messiah and about Jewish monarchy in general. So if you reread this pasuk with the ideas in here, if I go back and essentially just reread that pasuk, it says, Boaz said to her at mealtime, come here, i.e. closer to the monarchy, and eat bread, i.e. become a progenitress of the kings of Israel. Dip your piece in vinegar, which is a sign of great luxury. She sat beside the reapers and he handed a parched grain. And she ate and was so satisfied that left Shem over. She indeed took up the mantle of being the progenitress of the monarchy of Israel and was so blessed by that that she had far more than she ever thought she was going to get. We discussed about the seating plan last time. And with that, I think that there's just one more thing that I want to discuss with you. There is a Zohar Kodesh that is quoted by the Nefesh HaChaim, chapter 1. And it says that there's a certain way that mitzvahs have an effect in the world upstairs. And this is important. It says that every mitzvah that's performed in this world makes an impression in Shemaim. It makes some kind of effect upstairs as an outcome of the actual deed. And this spiritual light which happens upstairs, this is the writing which records every mitzvah that's performed. There's a tradition that every mitzvah we do is written down and it's sealed by Eliyahu HaNavi. It's countersigned by Eliyahu HaNavi. Does that mean, what does it mean it's written down? It means it's written down in the fact that it generates a particular spiritual light. God then countersigns this signature of Eliyahu HaNavi by maintaining those lights. So Eliyahu and Mashiach are the ones who have the influence to make the effect of mitzvahs manifest so that its impression is felt throughout the entire world. Consequently, there's no need for any man to fear that if he carries out a precept with a full and joyous heart, that others will suspect him of doing it without proper intentions. That's very important. So when Rus decides she is going to sit down next to him and there's going to be suspicions, what is he doing sitting next to this woman? If she's doing the mitzvahs, she's fulfilling the mitzvahs 100%, you don't need to be worried that there's going to be a suspicion directly if you're doing something which in and of itself is perfectly acceptable. Okay, getting on to Psukim, Tes Vav and Tes Sign. So we're in chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. Let's have a look at these two together because they represent an idea together. It says, V'tokam leleket. Leket, remember, leket is if two straws, two sticks of wheat or grain or barley fall, The farmer's not allowed to pick them up and he must let them glean. He must let them glean. But the person who is taking them can only take two at a time. If it's three, then he's allowed to come back and pick them up. So it says, then she arose to glean leket. Specifically, she went to go and get leket. She went to go and carry on with her job. And Boaz commanded his labourers, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves. Don't embarrass her. Even make sure, actually, he's rigging the system a bit, to pull out some for her from the heaps to leave them for her to glean, and don't rebuke her. Now, there's a few questions to be asked here on these psukim. Number one, why is Shmuel Hanavi writing it saying for Tokum, and she got up to go and glean leket? How else is she going to do it? Is she going to sit down and go out and glean? We just say she went to glean, not she got up to go and glean. We don't need the words to get up. We know that obviously she got up to go and glean. Two, another question is, why did Boaz wait so long to instruct the labourers? Why didn't he instruct them earlier before the meal? Three, another question. Already in verse 15, it's made clear that Ruth was allowed to take from sheaves. Yet in verse 16, we just heard that Boaz instructed his labourers to pull out some from the sheaves, which are smaller from the sheaves. If she can take from the sheaves, why are you telling them to pull out some individual sticks and throw those on the ground as like fake leket, as it were, that she can go and just let her go and take from a whole sheaf? It's a waste of time for her to pick up leket if you're going to let her take a sheaf. So that's the thing. If she can already take from a heap and they're not allowed to rebuke her, all the more so they're not going to rebuke her from taking leket, which are individual stalks, right? Okay. So the Alshech HaKadosh points out here that there's so much more than meets the eye to these psukim. He says, this is very interesting, that Boaz originally gave her, in the last pasuk that we just started with, in pasuk 14, two fingers full of parched grain. Now, it couldn't have taken her very... I don't know how much is in two fingers full, but I don't know, like half a cup? Not even. Half a cup of like barley grain. Like a nosh. It's more of a snack than a meal. Yet it said she was completely sated by that. But it really is just a snack, right? Now it couldn't have taken her too long to eat that. While Boaz and the rest of the men were still eating and she had been finished this little snacklet and she's been satisfied, she reckoned that if she remained in her place and waited until the rest had finished eating the proper meal, she had been faced with a very unpleasant situation. Number one, it would appear as if she were waiting for them to give her more, so she would look greedy. So she's finished, and they're like, oh, do you want more? Yes, please. And number two, they would suspect her of deliberately hanging about to have a chance to strike up a conversation with the men that were sitting there. And that would be unacceptable, right? So even that action of hanging around could be viewed in a bad light. That's why it says she got up, she left the table early to go and glean so that there'd be no questions of sneers issues. Even though she was fully right to sit there because everyone else was eating, because not everyone was being so fulfilled by the little that they ate as she was because she got a special bracha, but still she'd be sitting around not eating anything because she's full. So what is she doing hanging around this table, just gawping at everyone? Everyone's looking at her while she's not eating. She decided, you know what, I've eaten, I'll get up and I'll leave. There's nothing more for me to do by staying here. So Boaz told his workers to allow her to take from the sheaves and not embarrass her. What did he mean? He said, the only reason you have to suspect her is that she got up from her place in a hurry. Even if you find that she left all the single stalks lying on the ground and collected only from the sheaves, you must not question her or intimidate her. Because you might think that maybe she left in a hurry, not for sneers, but because maybe she wanted to steal some additional grain while no one was looking. She'd take more than two stalks at a time. He's saying, this is my grain, I'm giving it to her. So there's no reason to think of her as a thief. Now, she immediately got up to take the leket, which are permitted by law. And she did not mean to take from the sheaves, which would be unlawful. If you see a sheaf of wheat that's not yours, you can't stop picking from the sheaf of wheat. You can only take what's fallen on the ground or the corners of the field or leftover sheaves, which someone has forgotten. You can't just start pulling from the sheaves. That's theft, right? So he dismissed the possibility of any such allegation because he's already deemed anything she takes as a gift anyway. And even if there would have been no pretext for embarrassing her by claiming that she was cheating, they could have claimed that she was plotting to do something at some later stage, which is why she got up early to go and see where the sheaves are kept. And while no one's looking, she'll go and nick it. He says, no, that's not going to happen, not with her. But this all does seem a bit to smack of favouritism. This does sound like he's, you know, it's unfair. Why are you giving her so much positive regard to gift her all this wheat? Are you, is there some kind of favourite, have you got your eye on her? What's going on? Why are you treating her like this? Again, this is why he addressed it to his own private servants. He said to his labourers, he was saying, you may wonder what's happening and may have voiced your surprise at my strange actions of giving her all this gifted stuff, right? But the answer is as follows. I know she's not going to touch anything that she isn't required to by law. The only reason I'm telling you that I'm giving it to her as a gift is so you don't suspect her. But if you actually watch what she's doing, she's keeping everything banged down according to the halacha. Everything she's doing, she's only taking leket. She got up to do leket. That's what Shmuel and Avi means. She only took leket anyway. She only took what was allowable to her. That's extremely important. So he knew she wasn't planning on any theft. But others would think, we see from this how careful you've got to be with the suspicion of people who are unlearned. He knew that everyone's going to say, oh, she's gone to thief. She isn't going to thief, I'm giving it all to as a gift. But by the way, if you watch her, you'll see that she's not taking a thing outside of halacha. Like, oh, all right, really? And that was the case. If you look at verse 17, so she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat what she had gleaned, and it amounted to an ephah of barley. An ephah of barley. Now, I've done some maths here. An ephah, I just would like to go through what an ephah is. Okay, what is an ephah of barley? So if you look up, according to the Rach Noah, which is the smaller number, an ephah of barley is 24.8 litres. 24.8 litres of grain. So if you can imagine, you know one of those like cola bottles that holds 2 litres, like a 2 litre cola bottle. If you could imagine 12 of those full of grain, that's what she was able to gather just by picking up leftover stalks. That's a lot. Now, if you go according to the big estimate, which is the Chazan Ish, who looks at values larger than the Rach Noah, an ephah of barley is 43.2 litres. 43.2 litres. That's like 22 litre bottles full of grain. Do you think you could carry 22 litre bottles? That is a fortune of grain to pick up in a day. So it's either between 24.8 and 43.2 litres of grain, but it is a serious amount of grain. A serious amount. So obviously, that's what we're going to see in the next few Pesukim. Naomi was incredibly shocked with the amount of volume of grain that she managed to amass in her gleaning. So notice, Rus had absolutely no intention of gathering from the heaps or taking from among the sheaves. Boaz was already saying to his labourers, don't even think she will, but if she does, I'm giving it as a gift. But she's frum, and she won't take a thing that's not absolutely due to her. Proof of this is supplied by the small amount she was left with at the end of the day, an ephah. Had she have taken from the sheaves, she would have so much, she wouldn't be able to carry it. But it's still a lot of amount of barley. It's still 25 litres of grain. Now, it's interesting, gathering barley kernels are significantly larger than those of wheat. Had she have gathered wheat, the kernel content would have been far less. That's an interesting thing. So it says that she kept, verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18, she carried it and came to the town. Remember, she was in the fields and she went back to the main town. And her mother-in-law, Naomi, her mother-in-law, saw the amount that she gleaned. She took out and gave her what was left over, and she ate her fill. Now, why is it necessary in this pasuk, in pasuk 18, to inform us that she took the barley home with her? That is the most ridiculous thing to tell us. You go out gleaning in the field to get grain so you can eat. What do you think she's going to do? Stand in the middle of the field and make bread? How's she going to do it? Of course you're going to take it home. What's she going to mean? Where would she go? Just say when she got, just say she gave Naomi and we'd have to learn out. Well, that means at home. Where would she be? It wasn't in the field. Why do we have to be told she carried it and came to town? Is she not going to carry it? What's she going to put it in a wheelbarrow, get a limousine to take her there? Of course she's going to carry it. She's taking leket. She's a pauper. Two is, what's she going to do with it if not take it back? What would we expect her to do with it? Also, once Naomi had seen her, she'd obviously seen the bundle as well. Why do we need to be told that Naomi saw that she had gleaned? She knew the only reason she'd gone out to the field was to glean. Amazing, no? So let's have a look at this. A very interesting idea. There must have been some significance in the fact that Shmuel and Avi decided to tell us these two things. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said it. The most obvious explanation is that she had to beat it into a compressed area amounting to an effer so that she could even carry the load into town without asking for help. Had the amount of grain that she took remained in stalk form, she would have had to ask for an aid of passers-by. And as the Medrash tells us, the people of that generation were so steeped in sin that it would probably be a very dangerous thing to do for a woman such as Rus to ask a man to help her carrying a bundle of grain in the middle of nowhere. So she didn't want to ask anyone. So she had to be very, very careful about how she was going to transport this significant load back to town. That was why it was extremely difficult to find people who were trusted. And once all the grain was tied up in a sack, it would not be so conspicuous when she arrived in town. So there was less chance that she'd be degraded for collecting her daily sustenance from the fields. Also, out of sneers, nobody has to know that you're a pauper gleaning in a field. But if you walk in with a massive sheaf of wheat or whatever that you've tied up, everyone will know you've been going to do leket, which means you must be a pauper that needs to do gleaning. Okay, that's another form of sneers. You don't have to tell everyone the situation you're in. And it says she carried it herself and came to town inconspicuously. That's how you read into this pasuk. She carried it personally and carefully, stealthily got into town. Her mother-in-law was the only one that saw what she'd gleaned because she had revealed it to her. She opened the bag. And only, that's why it says, Naomi saw what. What does that mean? It means they opened the bag, she looked into it. Why was it in a bag? Because she decided to beat it out. One is that she didn't have to ask anyone else to help her carry it in. And two, she didn't want anyone else to know where she'd been. So she'd revealed what was in the bag to Naomi. Now, Rus noticed Naomi's look of amazement and thought to herself that Naomi was suspecting Rus that one of the reapers had laid eyes on her and gave her a tremendous amount more of grain as a gift to show affection, essentially to try to earn her favour. And that will be very unsneers, and Naomi will have bad views of Rus. So that was right. And we all knew how the reapers were behaving, that everyone had to be very careful with the reapers. Indeed, the Medrash Rus Rabbah 5:15 says the reapers were known to have stolen grain to pay prostitutes. That was something they did in those days. So it was quite likely or possible to say that the additional grain that she got might have been for something immoral, and Naomi would not be jumping to any long conclusion to think that's what was happening with her. And that's why Boaz would sleep near the pile of grain to prevent his workers from stealing the grain and engaging in licentious behavior. So it was like a security tactic. It says he slept by the grain. Why? Because otherwise the boys would come along, steal the grain and use it as a bartering tool. That's why he slept on the pile of grain. That's how bad the situation was back then. So again, you've got to take that into understanding as to why Naomi had to look at the bag and go, wow, where'd you get all this grain? What's going on with you? Now, so therefore, Naomi has very justifiable bad suspicion about Ruth. So Ruth gave her everything that was left after she had eaten her fill. With this, she was hinting that God had blessed the little she had so that she would be satisfied and can even leave over a lot. That's why it says that which she left over. That indicates a tremendous righteousness. Even though in normal circumstances there would have not have been enough, the phenomena took place so that Naomi would realize that Ruth had not accepted any sort of gift or bribe from some kind of young man that was trying to gain favor with her. If that were the case, God would not have blessed her with the ability to leave over. That's why the pasuk says she took out and gave her what was left over after she had eaten her fill. How come she's hardly eating anything? The food is blessed. Like with a parched grain, her food is blessed. Because she's blessed, because she's righteous. She doesn't need to eat so much. That's a Gemara Brachos, by the way, 58a, that says that. Also, Naomi was understood that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had blessed Rus by enabling her to leave over so that she should not wonder how she had managed to gather so much. Once Naomi realized that her intentions were pure by seeing the miraculous state of events of how she was eating, she then asked her in verse 19, her mother-in-law said to her, "My goodness, you've really done very well for yourself. Where have you gleaned today? How are you able to glean so much? And you even didn't even have to eat so much because of the brocha. And where did you work? May the one who acknowledged you be blessed." Ruth then related to her mother-in-law what she had done. The whole thing with Boaz and the workers and how he spoke to her and gave her some parched grain and she sat and she got up and all that bit. The whole story up until now, she's giving over to Naomi. She said, "The name of the man whom I worked with today is Boaz." Boaz. That's very interesting. By the way, his name wasn't Boaz. His name was Ivtsan. What does Boaz mean? It means base eyes. Two strengths. One strength was the fact that he was righteous enough to rescind the decree of the famine. And the second strength was that he went to war against the Philistine and he won. So because he was doubly strong, they called him Two Strength. It's very much like a Red Indian name. You know, like a, I don't know, like a guy, I don't know, if he wrestled with a bear, you'd call him Bear Fighter or something like that. His name was Ivtsan, but because he was doubly strong, people called him Too Strong, as in T-W-O, Too Strong. So Boaz just means by two eyes, strong, too very mighty, too mighty, right? So that was a nickname. Boaz was a nickname. So she said, the guy, you know, his name's Boaz. You didn't even call him Ivtsan, because everyone called him Boaz. That was his new nickname, you know what I mean? Okay, now the first question Naomi asks in verse 19, "Where have you gleaned today?" What good is it to know where she's gleaned? A better question would have been, "In whose field did you glean? Was he a righteous person or not?" The second question, "Where did you work?" is totally redundant. Totally redundant. Why are you asking the question? If she says, "I gleaned in Boaz's field," why do you need to know where you worked? It's very interesting, right? What's going on? Now, also confusing is the fact that Naomi asked Ruth questions and then blessed her benefactor before even finding out what the answer was. It could have been anyone. It could have been Adolf Hitler. Yamach Shemai, right? We don't know where she gleaned. She said like this, "Where have you gleaned today? Where did you work? May the one who acknowledged you be blessed." Don't you want to wait to give a broch until you find out where she's worked? And also, you don't need to know where she's worked. Just ask where she's gleaned. Something's up. Now, you could argue that when Naomi said that his name should be blessed, she was hinting at her desire to know his identity. But that does not explain why she ignored all the other queries. Another perplexing point, by the way, is the double mention of the word today. That's a very interesting thing. If you look carefully, there's a very interesting superfluousness there. It said, "Where have you gleaned today? And where did you work? May the one who acknowledged you be blessed." Ruth then related to her mother-in-law what she had done. She said, "The name of the man in whom I've worked today." Look at the word on the word hayom. If you have a look, the word hayom which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words in. Where have you gleaned today? And then at the word are Sisi Imoi Hayom Boaz. The name of the man whom I worked with today is Boaz. Just say his name's Boaz. Do you speak like that? Do people speak like that? Where did you go today? I went to the baker today. Just, you don't need to, you know, people don't speak like that. There's obviously something else going on. There's more to it, right? So there's a Medrash Rabbah 5:9 that points out that instead of the words "I've worked with him," it should have worked. He had worked with her. The reason why it prefers the former is to teach us more than the householder does for the poor does for the householder. It's an interesting thing. If you give a meal to someone who's poor, you're getting far more from that meal than the person who's just eating at your table. Obviously, if you give tzedakah and the person sits there and they get their tummy filled, that's a very big thing. They've got a nice meal and they feel sated. But you've got the mitzvah of tzedakah. So someone who's a big bal chesed, or does a lot of hachnosas orachim, and does a lot of hospitality, says, where have you gleaned today? Where did you work? It's really saying, I have worked with him, right? That's that, right? What does that mean? It means I did more for him than he did for me, because he gave me the opportunity to take leket. I was doing more for him. I was giving him mitzvahs of tzedakah. He gave me food. Do you hear that difference? It's a very interesting concept, no? It's one of the places that we learn out. It's also Gemara in Tarnis. The one who stays in the home and gives bread to the poor, which they can enjoy immediately, is greater than someone who gives someone who's poor money. If someone comes to your door and it's someone very poor, giving them the sandwich is a much bigger act of tzedakah than giving them £5. Because what do they have to do? They have to take that £5 and go to the shop. With that shop, they buy a sandwich and a drink, then they eat, and then they're sated. If you give them the sandwich and a drink now, you're saving the trip to the shop. So you're giving them the food, and you're saving them the trip, right? That's a very interesting idea, right? That's why Boaz gained more from Rus in spiritual terms, even though he had done a charitable act. All told, Rus had done more for Boaz than Boaz had done for Rus. That's an interesting thing. Interesting. Now, Naomi might have said to Rus as follows. I've noticed two strange things are happening here. You manage to gather an effort of barley, which is quite a large amount for one day's work. Obviously, where did you get that from? Two is, you were given parched grain to eat. So my question is twofold, says Naomi. Where did you glean today? How were you able to collect so much in just one day? Is this field blessed to such an extent that a single stalk that is left amounts to so much? Could it be, just like in Pharaoh's dream, that he dreamt of one stalk with 7 ears of grain growing off of it? Where did you go? Such a man is blessed. That's a crazy, hectic field. Where did you glean? Who is such a tzaddik that you get so much so easily? Naomi's second question refers to the parched grain Rus was given. It was very meritorious for your benefactor to give you a few extra noshi grains as well. Where did you do this? Who was the one who benefited spiritually by providing you so much tzedakah? If he's righteous and he's acting purely l'shem shemayim, for heaven's sake, then both of you, you and he, played a very important part in a big mitzvah. If, on the other hand, he was giving you all this parched grain only to flirt with you and find favor in your eyes and was attracted to you, then you did him a kindness, because by accepting the food from him, he gained a lot of credit, because at the end of the day, he still did tzedakah. However, he's forgone the opportunity to take advantage of this and was not able to do a mitzvah because he was doing it only for averas. So Naomi's question to Rus was, where did you work? Was it a suitable place? Was it a place of a tzaddik? Or was it a worthy person or not? Where have you gleaned? Is it some kind of magical field? That's number one. Number two, where did you work? Is it a place of tzidkus or rishus? Righteousness or wickedness? I want to know the environment you were in. I very much hope that your benefactor gave you this food for a mitzvah and not for anything else. So she told her mother-in-law the whole thing. She related the whole story. Therefore, she had realized that Rus's benefactor was indeed righteous and his intentions were l'shem Shemaim. So Rus was emphasizing that she had worked with him. With him. I worked with him. They had both played a part in effecting a great mitzvah. It wasn't just me. It was him and me because we both did mitzvahs because he's righteous. So when she says, I worked with him, she's explaining that he's righteous. We're both doing mitzvahs. That was her answer to Naomi. Don't worry, I worked with him. We're both being righteous here. You've got nothing to fear. The man, the name of the man whom I worked with today is Boaz. Right? So don't worry, we were both being frum. We were both being according to Shulchan Aruch. We worked together to do mitzvahs. And you need not worry that someone was getting up to no good. I wasn't getting up to no good. And he wasn't getting up to no good. We were working together with each other in order to do the right thing. Okay, so that explains the word with and why the two questions were being asked by Naomi. I've already explained to you that Boaz is two strongs, right? We talked about that. Do I go into the concept of why it says today? Okay, there's a deep Zohar Kodesh as to why the term today is mentioned twice. Where were you today? The name of the man I worked with Boaz today. What's going on with these todays? What's going on? So the Zohar Kodesh, volume 1, page 99a, explains something very interesting. It says as follows. The days which have been lived by a righteous person and have been used for Torah and good deeds become entities of substance, so that when a person leaves this world, they draw near to testify on his behalf before God. If you use a day correctly, let's call it, I don't know, the third of Tammuz, then the third of Tammuz at your court case comes before God and says, on my day, a tzaddik or a righteous man or woman used me correctly. And that day in and of itself becomes a defender for you. In our very verse, we learn this out. Naomi alluded to this when she mentioned, where in this world did you gather a day? Where did you get a yom from? Have your actions successfully been able to create a day which will be used in your benefit in Olam Haba? Were your intentions for heaven? Or were you both having intentions for immorality? That's why Rus answers her. So if you have a look carefully at the verse, Naomi said, where have you gleaned? Have you gleaned a day? Have you managed to glean and harvest a day in God's eyes? That was her question. At the end of the pasuk, the name of the man with whom I worked with today is Boaz. Both Boaz and I gleaned a day because we both did mitzvahs. You don't have to worry. That's what Naomi was asking about. How's your gleaning going? I remember Rabbi Pinchas Jung was giving a shiur and people went out. They said, listen, we can't stay for the whole shiur because you've got to find a mincha. We haven't done a mincha. We've got to go to mincha. He says, okay. So about 10 minutes into the shiur, they got up, done a mincha. It was a very long shiur. They done a mincha. They came back. So when they walked in, they didn't have to say anything. They could have just walked in, sat down, and everyone would have understood everything. But I remember they said, we found mincha. And Rabbi Jung said back to them, how did mincha find you? I.e., he was saying, it's all very well that you managed to find mincha, but how did the mincha prayer find you? Were you focused? Were you on it? Were you thinking about it? How did mincha find you? So too, did you find a day today? Yes, I found a day for this world and the next. And the person I made a day with was Boaz. These are days of substance. That's very, very important. Let's look at verse 20, a very interesting verse. So we're at chapter 2, verse 20. Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of God who has not failed in his kindness to the living and the dead." Naomi said to her, listen to these words very carefully, "The man is a relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers." What's wrong with that?
The sentences are the wrong way around.
Explain.
Should have said, she knows it's Boaz, so Naomi should have said, this man is related to us, he's one of our redeemers, and then she can say, blessed is he who has not left it of his kindness and to the living and the dead. Because, first of all, she recognizes he is a redeemer, and therefore...
I don't know, if you find out he's a family member, it's a nice thing to say anyway. I'll tell you what the problem is.
Once she says it's Boaz, then I assume that Naomi recognizes who Boaz is. He's a redeemer.
I don't see that's in any way a problem. I'll tell you what the problem is. Look at the words. For Ta'imela, she said to her, Naomi, Karov lanu. This man's a relative of ours. No, he isn't. He has nothing to do with Rus. Who's the word ours, lanu? He's no relative of Rus's. Who's she talking to? She should have said, this man's a relative of mine. It's a relative of mine. Who's she talking to? Oh, you're coming up with an answer. That does not fit in the text. That's very nice. But Naomi is informing Rus that Boaz is a relative of ours. In fact, he's only here. It's only her relative. There's a lot of questions here. We're informed that Rus is Naomi's daughter-in-law again. I don't know how many times we've been told this since we know what is the purpose of constantly telling us that Rus is Naomi's daughter-in-law. For goodness sake, would we not know that by now? Number two, Ruth seems rather negative in her praise of Boaz. Couldn't she be a bit nicer? Rather than saying about the kindness he's done, she just said, blessed is be he of he who has not failed in his kindness. For goodness sake, maybe he didn't even know about who Naomi was and his link. How can he say he hasn't failed in his kindness? What do you mean? She should have said he's an amazing man. He's been so kind. He's gone out of his way. What do you mean failed in his kindness? What is the word hachaim? Hachaim is in the plural. To whom is Naomi referring besides her for herself in the living or the dead? And who's the dead? If it's a reference to her dead sons, what connotation did they have with Boaz? Besides, they had married Moabite girls and deserved no recognition whatsoever. Naomi expressed her anger over her son's scandalous behavior, as we learn in 1:13. She didn't even call them her sons. She just called them my children. But they're not my sons. Also, why does it say, V'ta'imela Naomi? Naomi said to her, if we're already aware that Naomi is speaking to Rus, why do we need to be told that later? Look, it says, then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, blessed be he of God who has not failed in his kindness to the living or the dead. Naomi said to her, this man is a relative. Well, there's no change in the sentence structure. Why do we need to be told that the sentence continues that she's talking to? Of course it's a conversation between Naomi and Rus. Why do we need to be told in the middle of the conversation it's a conversation between Naomi and Rus? What's the difference between a relative and a redeemer? Every redeemer has to be related anyway. Just say he's a relative or say he's a redeemer and I'll learn out the other one. He's a family member. Oh, Efshe, he could redeem us. He's a redeemer. He must be family. Boaz was able to redeem only items belonging to Elimelech and his sons. As we've learned out previously, by the way, why did Naomi call him our redeemer if he had no connection to Naomi or Rus whatsoever? What's going on here? Nothing of this verse fits. Everything's weird. Interesting. Now, Clive did hop onto a sequence being relayed here, but essentially, this verse is a very, very difficult verse to understand. It seems very badly written, it seems. But everything that we see that's badly written is teaching us very deep ideas. Earlier we learnt that Boaz knew of Ruth's greatness, that the spirit of Mahlon was resident within her, waiting to be redeemed through a yibum, a Levirate marriage. Naomi, it seems, was also aware of this because she still considered Ruth to be her daughter-in-law, connected by the spirit of Mahlon. That's why she's saying, my daughter-in-law. What she's really saying is, you're still related to me through Mahlon, who's alive in you. Blessed be he of God. Now, the Medrash on Bereishis Rabbah 96:5 tells us, if your friend dies, do not care. If his son dies, you shall mourn. What a strange Medrash. So the Medrash is saying as follows, and deal with me in loving kindness and truth. In Genesis 47:29, is there another kindness which is false? So that Yaakov must say with loving kindness and truth. Imagine the son of a close friend died. This is the Medrash. Imagine a son of a close friend died. You would be sad and mourn for him. For if you died before your friend, perhaps he would repay you for your kindness and mourn for you. But if your friend dies, there is no reason for you to mourn, for he's no longer among the living to repay you for your concern. Do you hear that? I'll do it again. If your friend dies, there's no reason for you to mourn, to say, I'm only going to mourn that he should mourn for me if I die first. Now that he's gone, I know he can't mourn for me because I'm still alive. He said, no, again, we do that. There's an idea that maybe I'm doing something in kindness. I do something for you that you'll do it for me.
I saw the whole thing about...
Again. So we're saying like this. If someone is only going to do an act of kindness in the fact that you feel as if at some stage you could get repaid by that very same kindness, if you get a situation where this person dies, guaranteed your money back, they can't repay you that kindness. So you might think that a person might think that I'm not going to do it because there's absolutely nothing for me to gain because there's no way he'd return me any favour. That's what the Medrash is teaching us. Says Yaakov, if you are kind to me after my death, that is true kindness because you know you'll never be rewarded for it by me. And that is what Yaakov is telling Yosef on his deathbed. Do me a kindness, get my body out of this country. Now, I can't say that if you die, I'll do it for you and I'll get your body out of Egypt. I can't say that. So I'm asking for a chesed. I'm asking for a pure chesed because I know you wouldn't do it if you're not going to, if you're going to only do it for me, that I'll do it for you and we'd have that kind of reciprocal relationship. That's not going to happen here. Since Elimelech and all of his sons had died, there was no reason to favour his relatives because you couldn't say maybe a powerful man like Elimelech and his family will look after me. So I'll be seen to do the right thing. And if anything goes wrong with me, Elimelech and his family will pay their respects and do it for me or my family. Only Rus was left. And she had married Mahlon while she was still a Moabitess. So she was not legally the wife of Boaz. So she was not legally the wife of Mahlon, I apologise. Therefore, Boaz had absolutely no need to do kindness to Naomi or to Rus, because his connection was only to Elimelech and his sons. He had no reason to say, oh, I'll do this as some kind of family debt that I've got to pay, and maybe Elimelech and his sons will look after me. So Naomi told Rus that since Boaz acted out of pure kindness to help Rus out, she was indebted to him. For he was not bound to Naomi or Ruth in any way and would not stand to gain any benefit from being kind to them. Because Naomi and Ruth can't do anything for him in that particular case. So what does it mean, the living and the dead? The living refers to Naomi and her son Mahlon, whose spirit is still alive in Ruth. The dead refers to Mahlon himself, as well as Elimelech and all of his brothers. Ruth, however, simply didn't understand these references. This was beyond her. She had no idea that the spirit of Mahlon was pulsating within her, while Naomi did. She was newly converted, and her marriage to Mahlon had taken place prior to the conversion. So Naomi found it necessary to explain this and let Ruth know of the unique situation she was in. Rabbisa, you have to understand, this is a watershed moment in Ruth. This is the first time in Megillas Ruth, chapter 2, verse 20, that Naomi is explicitly saying to Ruth, my son's neshama is inside you still alive. She's saying that out. And this is the first time Ruth has any inkling that there's a possibility that Mahlon could be reincarnated through Yibam. This is the first time that Ruth is aware of this. That's why she said again, the man is a relative of ours. Yes, he is even your relative via Mahlon. He's related to you by my son. He's really related to Elimelech and the sons. That's who he's a redeemer of. And you are carrying a bit of my son. And that's how you're related to him. He's a relative of ours. I'm not asking you to marry him because of his gentle manner towards you. But since you are connected to me through Mahlon, he is still just as much your redeemer as he is mine spiritually. He can therefore put the spirit of Mahlon at rest by redeeming you through Yibam. This is the first time Ruth has ever been told this. She didn't know that. This, says the Al Shech HaKadosh, is a wake-up call for Ruth. Ruth did not understand the depth of it until verse 20. Now, this is such a watershed moment that you can imagine that Ruth is going to be quite shocked to hear all this. If we understand the depth of what's going on here, then Naomi is over the moon. She's like clapping her hands in joy, going, oh my gosh, what hashkacha protis? We've got a man who is connected to the soul that's inside you. What do you mean? What soul? What? And Mahlon's alive? What? Yibam? What? How's this going to work? Obviously, she was a bit taken aback. In verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess. Notice, not the daughter-in-law of Naomi. All this time we've been told, daughter-in-law of Naomi, daughter-in-law of Naomi, daughter. Now she's back to being a Moabitess, which, by the way, is a derogatory statement. That's why the farmhand who called her Ruth the Moabitess is considered insulting. So much so, Boaz kind of veiled a reply of apologising for that, saying, don't listen to what he said. It's okay, I've told him off and everyone's going to look after you. It's like saying, you know, Ruth the Nazi. Let's say a woman who was a Nazi and she was a member of the Nazi youth converted and became a Rebbetzin. I don't know. So you turn her name's Gittel. She called her Gittel the Nazi. That is not a nice thing to say. So we see her all the time. She was daughter-in-law of Naomi. Now she's back to Moabites. He also told me, stay close to my servants until they have completed all my harvest. Now Rus is derisively described as a Moabites, even though she was by then a fully fledged Jewish woman under Naomi's tutelage. The Medrash Rabbah 5:1 explains that Shmuel Hanavi described her like this because we found fault with her because she deliberately misquoted Boaz, who had said that she should stay close to the young women in the field. That's an interesting thing. Who were the women in the first category? What's going on? What? He told me, stay close to my servants until they have completed the harvest. That's a very interesting thing. These original women that she met, remember I told you there was like a festival in those days. They made like a festival where they would put up like a canopy in the fields when the harvest was coming in, and all the women would come into from town to come and glean, then they would go away. So he called her, he said to her, "You are like one of my handmaidens. You are like one of the girls in my home." And we said she had jumped up from being a stranger, an Ochriya, to being a Jewess, and then to being a Shifcha, a handmaiden in Boaz's retinue, right? So they had remained in his household with a hope that they would soon remarry and once more have the honor of waiting on the wife of Boaz. That's what all these girls were doing. So she had said something which wasn't accurate. So Shmuel Hanavi calls her Ruth the Moabites. Now Boaz told Ruth that she should remain with his maidservants in the field, but he made it clear that the women folk would remain only in one particular field, the first field to be harvested. "If that doesn't suffice for you," he continued, "and your eyes are on the next field," if you see verse 9, "you need not refrain from gleaning there, even though the women folk won't be present. You should follow behind the laborers in that field, even though they're men. Go behind them and imagine that they're women." It's for that reason, in verse 9, it says, "And you shall go after them in the feminine, achrehen, with a nun." Even though the subject of the verse is men, treat them as women. Ruth was to consider them as women and not fear them at all. Boaz emphasized, however, that she should follow behind them and not mingle with them. But anyway, he said, "Don't even go there. Stay in this field, which is only inhabited by women." As to the problem of what to do if she were confronted by one of them, or they started abusing her, Boaz addressed her as follows: "I've told my labourers not to touch you. I've told the overseer, who's a member of my household, that he should ensure that my instructions are strictly obeyed. Even though you may still feel safe at keeping a distance behind them, you still don't have any fear because of my personal protection on my personal servants, and they can be trusted. But you shouldn't go to another field, which isn't mine." He said, "Don't go to another field." That sounded like he had his eye on her. If you remember from last week, that's not like, "Don't leave my field." What is he saying? If you go out of my field, I've got no rights over those overseers. I can't tell them off and leave you alone, and maybe they will molest you. I know my servants will trust me. I've told them to leave you alone. You're safe in my field. Don't leave my fields. Leaving my field, I can't protect you. Ruth then did not exaggerate when she related those events. She rightly said that Boaz had told her to stay with the young women only in one field. As to the other fields, Boaz did allow her to follow behind the men as long as she didn't associate with them, treating them like women. And Boaz did permit her to mingle with his servants because they were instructed to leave her alone. So Ruth can't be condemned for being a liar. The command to stay close to the girls applied only to the first field. When he said, "Stay close to my servants," he was permitting her to associate with them as opposed to the other labourers who she was told to follow behind until the end of the harvest season. So Ruth is not totally exonerated, though, from the accusation levelled against her. She was still extremely righteous, and that's why God deemed her fit to still be the progenitor of Shlomo, but she didn't speak absolute truth to Naomi. And because of that, Shmuel called her a Moabites. She did alter Boaz's words, because Rabbi Yochanan on Rus Rava says that she discredited Boaz by misquoting him. She did not misquote Boaz in order to bring his name into disrepute, but she did misquote him. So there's no doubt, but she did alter Boaz's words when she related that he had told her to stay close to his servants. She should have said, "Go with my servants," or "Stay near my servants." But the meaning of staying close attachment would not have been a modest thing for her to do. So she didn't relate exactly correctly, and that gave Naomi the wrong end of the stick. So what's going on here? She's starting now to get very detailed in trying to say what's been going on, because she's been hit by the sledgehammer of what was revealed to her in verse 20. She's now starting to go through very clearly every single detail about Boaz, because she starts to understand his importance in her life to come. Naomi is essentially telling her, this man is a link to you through the spirit of Machlon, which is alive in you. You're going to need to be married to him through Yibam. That's news to Rush. She didn't have the faintest dream of this in verse 19 or earlier. Now she's like, wow, you want to know about Boaz? I'd better tell you every little, you know, jot and detail. You're going to become a shadchan. You know what I mean? There's like, you know, we're going to make a shidduch of it. He doesn't know it yet, but I'd better relate this to you. So she started relating. What she related, though, was inaccurate. So she was termed Rustam Urbites as a veiled insult. You've got to get the data correct. And so much is on the line. If she's found wanting, she won't marry Boaz. And if she's not going to marry Boaz, she's not going to become the mother of royalty. So it's all on the line for her. But Ezra Shem, what we'll look at next time is verses 22, 23, and that's the end of the chapter, which will take us through to the end of that chapter and the beginning of chapter 3, to explain how Rus had to bide her time in dealing with Boaz. She now may have known more about Boaz's role than Boaz did. Boaz did not understand that he was to marry her and release the soul of Mahlon and build the royalty. But Naomi, who has got the global picture, has now revealed this to Rus. So now Rus and Naomi are more in tune and in data than Boaz was. So there had to be a plan as to how to deal with Boaz, which is why more details about Rus's engagement and detailings with Boaz had to be done very, very carefully with Naomi, to get a plan together for an actual redemption to happen through this extra legal yibum that we talked about. I look forward to finishing off the whole perek, which is halfway through Rus, next time. And if I can, I would like to at least get to the first three verses, at least, into the third chapter, which is starting to set up a huge scene here, where we're literally going to be building up to the actual yibum itself, right? And I mean, it all really starts getting at verses 5, 6, and 7, and 8. That's when it was at midnight that she approached Boaz on the threshing floor. So we need, before we to get to that denouement moment, which is chapter 3, verse 8, to understand how they came to the decision that this was the only way to do business. Why didn't they publicly confront him in a normal way with a rov and a dayan? Explain the situation, say to Boaz, look, it's very interesting, you're actually related to us in a completely normal way, which would seem to make perfect sense. Why stealthily sneak into him in the middle of the night and lie at his feet? What's going on? Does anyone behave like that? There's reasons for that, but we've got to build that up now from the fact that Rus and Naomi are now in tune with something which Boaz himself isn't. And he doesn't know that until verse 9 in chapter 3. But they've been, you know, up to speed with this right from then. So, but Be'ezus Hashem, we will do that next time. I really appreciate you taking this time out to be able to continue this. I think we've got a good way through Rus at this stage. We're about pretty much halfway through the Megillah. And hopefully we can start seeing the denouement moment, the real crux moment, is just a few pesukim away. We have to understand why things are happening like that. Right back to the beginning, the intro, we said, why is God using these roundabout, circuitous ways of getting Mashiach into the world? You know, we talked about Yehuda and Tamar and Lot and his daughters and Dovid and Bathsheba, which we'll maybe talk about at the end. What's going with Rus and Boaz? Frankly, it seems, from where we're at so far, the whole thing's completely posh. They should have just taken a taxi, just spoken to Boaz, sat him down around the table with witnesses and said, look, this is the situation. Obviously, something's afoot. So we have to understand what's going on and why. Be'ez Hashem, we'll try to do that next time. I hope you have a wonderful week and a good Shabbos, and I look forward to seeing you there.